market,
the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money. Stand by. This week, we're getting darker than Metallica and more down than Nirvana. I'm Andrew Page, and as always, I'm joined by Scott Phillips.
This is where I normally say, g'day, Andrew, g'day, fools, but I'm already feeling a little bit down, Andrew. What's going on?
Mate, grab some supplies, head to your nearest bomb shelter.
Oh, shotguns and baked beans time, is it?
Sell everything. Or should you? This week, we're getting all doom and gloom. We're all about the glass half empty, and we're going to talk about the upcoming market crash.
Here it comes.
That's right. We're calling it. It's going to happen. We're going to talk a bit about what you need to do, and specifically some of the companies that you might think about buying, and probably even more importantly, the companies that you want to avoid.
Aren't we the optimists, Andrew? Aren't we the positive guys that think the market is great and everyone should be investing?
Yes, but you
we're
know,
talking look, about the crash.
Mate, you
coming.
Don't want to bury your head in the sand. These things happen. So, look, this is the fact, right?
The closet pessimist in us all is coming out.
Look, you know, doom and gloom sells, right? So, speaking of doom, Dr. Doom, as he's known, was in the AFR a day or two
Mark
ago.
Mark Faber.
And he's saying that the West needs a good recession.
Oh, don't we all love a good recession? Just bring it on.
Flush out of the system.
There is nothing better I like than rising unemployment, lower spending, lower economic activity. Bring it on, I say.
This guy's got a bit of a track record. No. It's not just him. There's RBS, big investment bank. At the start of the year, they made headlines with their sell everything call. Now, even beyond that, we've got a mining boom that's still ending. We've got inflated debt levels. There's stagnant wages, waning investment. We talked just last week about this looming oversupply in apartments. There's a lot of reasons for this to happen.
Hang on, I'm just getting my brokerage account. I'm about to sell everything.
Mate, look, the other thing we can say too is the market, like just statistically, when you sort of look at, you know, the lessons of history, the market is down 1 year in every three. We tend to get a major correction. Again, these are averages, but really roughly every 7 years or so. And mate, it's been 9 years since we had the last crash.
Time for a crash.
We're overdue.
When is it coming?
We are overdue. So a crash is coming.
Yeah, when?
Here's the thing. I don't know when.
Oh, okay.
Do you?
No idea.
Okay. Here's the other thing that we don't know. Although we know one is coming, we don't know when it's going to come. We don't know what's going to trigger it, which is really important as well. And even when it does come and, you know, we then figure out what's sort of caused it, we don't know how far it's going to fall. Is the market going to correct by 22%? Is it going to drop, 50% like it did in the GFC? And there's a big difference between those kinds of numbers.
Right.
So, How do we unwrap all of this?
Yeah, look, here's the thing. There is always going to be a crash coming. There always has been. There always will be. As far back as the South Sea Bubble, as far back as Tulip Mania, these things have been an absolutely common occurrence. They've been a common feature, a permanent feature of the economic and investing landscape. Mm. There is going to be a market crash.
Mm.
The question for investors is, when is it coming and how do you play it? You mentioned Mark Faber before, Dr. Doom. He's the guy who's called Dr. Doom because he's always doom and gloom. Except the market's up about 25% for the last 30 years.
Right,
so
right.
I'm not sure how you get to be doom and gloom with that sort of growth, but it always makes for great headlines.
Well, let's take the idea seriously, right? So I think there's one thing you could say is that if you were back in 2006 and you knew what was around the corner, I mean, had you sold out then, you would have saved yourself. Two things would have happened, in fact. You would have avoided a whole bunch of losses, right? Not only that, you've kind of had your cash protected, you can come back in at the bottom. You can buy those same stocks for half of the price. And in fact, the best gains in the share market are always made from the bottom of these crashes. If you
buy
can get
high
in
and sell low.
Buy low and sell high.
Oh, right.
and so
that easy, right?
So what's wrong with that?
Oh, it's easy. All you got to do is know when the market's going to top out and when the market's at its bottom. How high can that possibly be?
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? And it comes back to that opportunity cost. So the people who have been out of the market for the last 5 years waiting for this crash, while their money's been sitting in a term deposit somewhere perfectly protected, the opportunity cost, what they would have otherwise made, is substantial. And it gets to a point where even if there was a crash, they're still going to be worse off than they otherwise would have been.
Andrew, let's use a property analogy. Now, I don't mind Steve Keen as a general rule. I'm occasionally on Sky News Business with him, and we have a bit of banter across the Skype link from London where he's based. Steve Keen famously back in the day, and I want to say it was maybe 10 or 15 years ago now.
Yeah, about then.
Not only did he make a bet with an economist that he lost and had to walk to the top of Kosciuszko, but he sold his house on the basis of a house price crash that was coming.
Mm.
And it was coming.
Mm.
And it was coming. And it's still not here.
Mm.
Now, say what you like about Steve Keen. You can agree with him or disagree with him. Selling out of his house at that point because of the crash he saw coming has cost him an absolute squillion. He's probably lost somewhere in the range of a double or a tripling of his house price because he was waiting for the crash that didn't come. Now, for him to actually make money at this point, houses have probably got to fall, I'm going to guess, about 60, 65% just for him to get back to square. And after waiting 15 years for that to happen. Now, I'm not ragging on Steve Keen for the sake of it. It's just a really good example of what can happen if you forecast something like that. RBS has sell everything, call as you say. If everyone had sold everything back in February and then not got back into the market, hey, who knows what's going to happen next? But certainly it's been, you know, 10 months now since they made that call. And we're not at that sell everything type crash they'd predicted. And that's the big challenge. You've talked about opportunity cost. In real dollars and cents, if the market goes up 30% and falls 10, you can be right about the fact that it's going to fall. But if it doesn't fall back to where it is today, you're actually worse off. You're better off to invest through the gains and then through those losses. You're still ending up ahead. And that's a really, really important point.
You know, another thing I've heard you talk about before is this concept of generals fighting the last war. You know, this, I think, was it?
One of my favorite phrases.
It's a great one, isn't it? And Mark Twain said something like, you know, history rhymes, but it doesn't repeat. And, you know, so when we were in, you know, after the 87 crash, everyone was looking for the next 87 crash, the same kind of thing. And then it was internet stocks, you know, and that they were, and then after that, everyone was very wary of internet stocks.
And Amazon is up about 20-fold in the last 10 years
for
the record.
Right, you know, and so, and now we're looking at things like, you know, the state of the financial markets, we're looking at debt levels, we're looking at the things that precipitated the GFC.
You got it.
And what I think what we miss is that, although there's these crashes, these market corrections are a regular feature, they're never the same. You know, there are similarities, but they're never the same. So if you're trying to gear your investments around what would have helped you in the last correction, it's not necessarily going to help you in the next correction.
Yeah, I've got to say too, let me come back to that, but I hate the word correction with an absolute passion, Andrew. The media use it, we use it. You never notice the market never corrects up or corrects down. Like somehow down is better, but up is worse.
Right. Okay.
You know, we got it wrong on the way up. We didn't get it wrong on the way down.
What word would you use?
Fall?
Fall. Let's just
call a spade an effing shovel and be done with it, right? It's a fall is a fall. Has the market corrected up 100% since the GFC? I doubt it.
We don't say that, right?
We say, oh, corrected down 40%. It's absolute garbage. Now, back to your particular point.
Okay.
Generals fighting the last war is such an important point because think about the, you know, no one saw the GFC coming. The credit crisis that predicated the GFC, there were X number of people, call it, I don't know, you know, five, six people. And the Big Short, the movie, showed those people in their all of their glory. They showed what happened in that period of time. Yes, those three people got it right. It doesn't show the three people who were wrong 5 years before that. It doesn't show the 50,000 people who made other bets about everything else that was going to go wrong and were wrong about that. And it doesn't show the people subsequent to that who bought at the bottom of the GFC and have done incredibly, incredibly well since that point. So we tend to highlight the Dr. Dooms, the Nouriel Roubinis of the world, the Mark Fabers of the world. We say they're right when they're right one time out of 10. We don't say they're wrong the other nine times. And so generals fighting the last war is about, we take what our last experience was. The GFC wasn't caused by the same thing as the 87 crash. It wasn't caused by the same thing as the dot-com crash, to your point. So this is exactly the problem with this sort of thinking. It's this sort of magical thinking that somehow what happened last time is going to happen next time. If all I can do is be careful of those things, I'll avoid the next recession. It's almost always true. There are always similarities, right? Recessions tend to follow low interest rates, so tick. Tend to follow lots and lots of debt bubbles, so kind of tick, right? We've got lots of debt in the Australian economy. There are things that absolutely predicate a crash. And you know what it almost always is? It's irrational exuberance before it. It's people taking too many risks with too many things. Growth gets out of hand. Debt gets out of hand. Confidence gets out of hand. Those are the seeds of the next fall, but they're very rarely in the same thing. 2006-07, it was housing. It was also government debt, by the way, in Europe that we don't think about much anymore. In 99, it was tech stocks. In 87, it was other things. You know, the Gordon Gekko, greed for want of a better word is good. That's the sort of thing that is constant. But fighting the last war, is it going to be a credit crisis next time? Probably not. Is it going to be a tech crash next time? Probably not. Or if it is, it's going to be the tech crash that echoes the 99 crash, not the GFC. So just don't. Extrapolation is going to cost you a lot of money. History rhymes. The rhyming is the attributes that lead towards those things. But history doesn't tell you the timing, it doesn't tell you what industry or assets, what the actual cause is, or more importantly, what the real spark is that starts the flames.
Look, I think all of that's true, but at the same time, again, play devil's advocate here, I don't think that you should just always throw yourself at investing in the share market with complete gay abandon. You know, this idea that it'll always be all right, you know, I don't have to worry about it. I mean, there are some things that you can do, to your point before, that there are things that are eternally true. And when you go back and you dissect the last crash, correction, fall, whatever you want to call it, you know, there are different reasons behind that, yep. but it's the same kind of things that tend to get people in trouble.
Yes.
So although the specifics will always differ a little bit, let's try and center in on the common ground. Now, I think one of the things that really stands out whenever there is a problem in the market and the economy is that it's the highly leveraged companies that really struggle. You mm-hmm. know, shareholders can probably do without a dividend or a bit of a dividend cut there, but the banks are still going to want their pound of flesh. They're going to want, once you pay that back, you might need to refinance that debt. If you can't do it, guess what? You're insolvent. And even if the underlying business is wonderful, you're just not around to participate in the recovery. So debt is something I think you have to watch very, very carefully.
Yeah, totally. It's really important not to try and be too clever with this stuff. So trying to work out which company will do well, which company won't do well, you know, when to invest, when to time. Timing the market is a mug's game. Timing the market is a mug's game. Time in the market is the way to play it. So don't try and time your exit, entry and exits. You'll be wrong more often than you're right by definition. And quite frankly, the market goes up more than it goes down. So the longer you try and play that game, statistically, the worse off you will be, unless you get incredibly lucky. And frankly, none of us have that much luck that we can well and truly offset the growth of the market. That being said, as you say, there are companies to avoid, there are circumstances to avoid, and frankly, they should probably be avoided most of the time. Mm. But the longer we've been since the last recession or the last downturn, the more nervous you should be about what might possibly go wrong. Mm. If for no other reason, people forget things are cyclical.
Yeah.
Every analyst, every forecast you see extrapolates some sort of growth into the future. Mm. It's going to grow 5% a year, 7% a year, 10% a year. Mm. Sure, but
nothing moves in a straight line.
Well, there's going to be a recession at some point during that period, right? And so if you think about a company's earnings, a company's sales, the company's market, there's going to be downtimes. Mm. And you're going to have to wade through those downtimes. We're absolutely in the embrace volatility camp. We're the sort of guys who say, you know what? This is going to be a bumpy ride, but gee, the journey's worth it. Mm. Stick with it. The waves are worth it, because at the end of those waves, once you get through them, you're going to be much, much better off than if you hadn't played the game at all. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. But you don't have to buy every company on the exchange. You don't have to buy companies that have a risky balance sheet, to your point, have too much debt. Companies that have a very volatile customer base, for example. Companies that are likely to be disrupted by technology. And one of the ones that people, I think, forget more often than not, because it's been such a long time, it's been 25 years since a recession in Australia. We talked about the last market downturn in the GFC, but there wasn't a recession here. Mm. Looking at the way companies operate, it's the third and fourth players in industry that more often than not get hurt. Mm. The best companies in the industry actually benefit through those times. So look at
they lose competitors, right?
Look at a Harvey Norman, for example. Mm. Clive Peters has gone by the wayside. Dick Smith's gone by the wayside. Yeah. The local electronics retailer's gone by the wayside. Yeah. JB Hi-Fi's still there. Harvey Norman's still there. But Harvey Norman is stronger now than it has been almost at any point in its life, because it is one of the last two remaining surviving electronics retailers. Mm. Single example. So I'm not saying buy the best at any price. What I am saying is, if you buy the best quality, the best performing businesses in any industry, if you know that industry is going to survive, if you avoid companies with too much debt, you're giving yourself the best chance, not of avoiding volatility, you're going to suffer that either way, but of when you get the return, the recovery, it's going to be much, much better than you expected.
You really touched on a key point there too. And it's
unusual for me.
Yeah, I know. That's why I thought I'd highlight it. Because
can we put this in the highlight reel for the end of the year?
We talk about risk. And we talk about volatility, but they're not the same thing. Although I think it's great something point. That people tend to confuse. So
that was a great point. You're right.
It was a good point. Yeah. So people come into the market, they buy something, it falls down 10% next week. Week after, it's up 10%. You know, month down, it could be down 20%. Could be down 30%. You know, these things happen.
Correct.
If you're me, they happen a lot. And
that's also a good point.
But the thing is, it doesn't actually. I don't see that as risk. I just see that as the nature of the beast. I mean, I don't invest in the market because I think it's going to be a smooth and steady, right? That volatility is the price of admission. It's what I have to pay to get the outsized returns.
Here's the thing, Andrew. You can get 2% a year in the bank forever with no downturn.
Zero risk. Okay.
Or you can get something closer to 9 or 10% a year investing in shares.
Yeah.
But that means every, as you've already mentioned, the very top of the program, 1 year in three, we're going to have a down year.
Yeah.
So do you want an average of 10% or do you want an average of 1%?
Yeah.
If the answer is 10, great. Yep. But remember, that's an average of 10%. That means you're going to have to bear the slings and arrows of the market.
Yep.
Of fortune, if you like, over time, the volatility, knowing that the long run gives you that sort of return for those who can be patient. There's an old saying that the stock market is a great mechanism for transferring profits from the impatient to the patient.
Totally.
And that's really the story of investing.
Yeah, and you mentioned also before time frame, and just to really sort of tease that distinction out between volatility and risk, is that the longer your time frame, the less important volatility is. Now, this is a verbal medium, so this is going to be hard to describe.
Out, everyone sit down, close
your eyes.
I'm going
to try and describe a chart here. One of my favorite charts. And what it does is it shows the average return on a one-year basis for the share market.
Yep.
And then it looks at the average return over a two-year investment period.
Stay with us.
A three-year, five-year, and 10-year.
Right.
And as you move out there, so if you're going to say, listen, I've got a bit of cash I'm going to invest for 1 year. For a lot of people, amazingly enough, that's actually considered the long term.
Yeah, I know.
It's crazy short term. But if you do that, you are essentially flipping a coin. You know, statistically, there's a 50% chance that a year later you would have made some money, 50% chance you would have lost money. And that's not investing, right? And that, by the way, that's even if you're just invested in an ETF, a very broad, diversified sort of, you know, set of companies.
Right.
Go to 2 years and that risk drops dramatically. Now, once you get to 5 years, your chance of making a loss is decreased substantially. And at 10 years, there's no period in Australia's history, when we're including dividends here, of course, as we rightly should, where you would have ever made a loss. Now, that's had you invested, you know, the year of the tech wreck, the year of the start of the 1987 crash, you know, the GFC, et cetera, et cetera. So even if you have the worst timing in the world, if you've got that time frame there, all of a sudden that risk just falls away because the volatility doesn't matter to you. If you're day trading, volatility is everything and it is absolutely risk.
And you're mad.
And you're mad, absolutely.
So look, the key, you've done a great job of illustrating that. You draw us a word picture, Andrew, of that graph. The net result here is the longer you invest for, the lower the chance to almost zero of getting a negative return, and the larger the chance of you getting the market average return, which historically has been around 10%, give or take, when you include dividends to that. And by the way, in Australia, you include franking credits, you're getting up to 11 or 12%.
Yeah. I think it's the thing that undoes a lot of people. A lot of very smart people out there, they go into the market, they actually do it in a sensible way. They diversify, they buy good companies, they pay attention to the price they pay, and they go in with the intention of holding it for the long term, but they do it, and for whatever reason, you know, 8-12 months later, they're seeing a 30% loss on their thing. And it is, I'm not being critical because it's the most natural thing in the world. You panic and you sell. I've lost 30%. Everyone's talking about the next 30% that's going to fall. Mate, I am just going to take my money out and then I'm going to wait for things to get better. And unfortunately, what happens is that people tend to get drawn into the market when things are going great. So it's FOMO. It's fear of missing out. I want to make some money. I get in there. Naturally, it's volatile. I've lost a little money. Hell, I'm out. And to your point before, it is that you were literally buying high and selling low. And then the other thing, and I'm guilty of this too, the other thing that people say is, you know, oh, I'm going to wait for the next trade. When it crashes, that's when I'm going to plow all my money into the market. The problem with that is, even though it's actually an entirely sensible thing to do, is that you never behave the way you think you're going to, because when the market has crashed, everyone's panicking. All the experts are saying this is going to go on forever. You know, you might even get close to the bottom, but it could still fall in a very, very painful fashion. And then it could take 3 or 4 years for it to come good. So you are very likely not going to behave in the fashion you feel you're going to behave.
You're wrong.
Is that why?
You're wrong.
It was the first for everything.
No, you're exactly right, except for one thing.
Okay.
You said, if you're going to keep your money out of the market, wait for a crash, that's an eminently sensible thing to do. I don't think it is.
Oh, sorry. No,
I think it's a crazy thing.
Well, that
to
goes against our earlier point.
Well, and that's the point, right? So it's smart intellectually.
It's a perfectly sensible thing to think, is probably what I should have said.
And that's an important distinction, right? So if you knew when the crashes were going to come and the recoveries were going to come, of course you would. Mm. If you said there's going to be a crash in 3 months' time, you knew that for a fact, not just because you guessed it or assumed it, because most people do.
Yep.
If you knew, of course you would sell everything, you keep your cash and you wait for a crash.
The exact bottom and pile in. Yep.
And you would have sold it in 2007 and bought back in 2009, and you'd be a squillionaire right now.
Right.
That's a different story, though. Most people who do that, if you've been at... So in 2010, there were a whole heap of headlines. Mm. Double dip recession coming. The US was going to go through another crash. It was going to be terrible. It was going to be, you know, all this... The real recession was still to come, all that kind of rubbish. If you'd have not invested in 2009, or you'd sold out in 2009 because the next recession was coming, you would have lost an absolute fortune, either in real money or in the chance to make some money, because you said, I'll wait until the bottom.
Okay.
I'll do that. I'll do the right thing. So it feels sensible. If the market falls 10% tomorrow, right? You probably lose something like 10 or 15 months worth of gains. So in other words, if you're sitting on the sidelines now waiting for the next 10% crash, and the market goes up 11% in the meantime, you're actually worse off. And betting against the market gain, because the market goes up more than it goes down, it goes up on average about 10% a year, the chances of you being right, of having that money aside and having to invest it at the right possible time, is just incredibly, incredibly, incredibly unlikely. Yeah. Like the Steve Keen example, you sell your house, wait for the crash to come to reinvest it. Mm. He couldn't possibly get back into the market at the same price with the same sort of house. Short of an absolute catastrophe in the Australian economy, literally a proper catastrophe where house prices fall by 2/3. Mm. You can't get back in time. So waiting and holding your money outside the market, waiting to invest, feels smart. You feel like the smartest guy in the room.
Yep.
The opportunity cost will absolutely kill you more often than not.
I think the other thing too, we're only talking about half of the equation here. That equation being, you know, what did I buy it? What did I sell? Not an important part, obviously, but, you know, call me old fashioned, but I think there's actually great benefits in ownership, even if the market was closed and I could never sell. So obviously we're talking here about dividends. Traditionally make close to half the total returns up over the long term.
Right.
And there are some really wonderful lessons when you go back and you look at past crashes. So companies whose share prices were absolutely devastated, but in terms of what they were earning and able to reward their shareholders with, that actually, you know, if you couldn't look at the share price and all you could look at was your dividend checks coming in, mm-hmm. I would argue very strongly that for a very significant number of companies in the GFC, you wouldn't have known there was a GFC. So we had even the thing, good old boring Telstra, its dividends held steady right throughout that period. And they've since increased. Retail Food Group, API, Salt Pats, we've talked about before on the program, CSL, mm-hmm. these are all companies who not only continued their dividend, their dividends increased from 08 to 09, from 09 to 10. It went up.
Yep.
And I think that's another thing too. When you've got that time frame at your side where you're not a forced seller at any point and you can afford to sort of, you know, let things come back, although it's a painful ride, the cash that's coming into your bank account every 6 months or so is actually likely to be fairly decent.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
So Scott, we always do this. We go way too long. Let's get to...
Surely not. Listeners must be enjoying our dulcet tones, I'm sure, Andrew.
And if they'll probably listen to it 8 times
I can hear
it
now.
This.
More. Keep going.
It's all in your head.
it normally is.
We said at the start some stocks.
Yes.
That you would be interested in having in your portfolio in preparation for this upcoming crash. Give me a name.
Look, I think there's... I'm going to duck the question slightly, quite frankly, because you've almost answered it already.
Right.
The question is, in which stocks do you want for the crash? It's the fact that you don't sell out quality businesses if there is a crash. Mm-hmm. So I'm a long-term investor, as all our listeners hopefully are as well. I'm investing for 10 years and beyond. Mm-hmm. I don't care which stocks I have in my portfolio during the crash if they're quality businesses.
Yep.
I don't care what happens to the share price.
Yep.
Flight Centre went from $17 10 years ago to $4 during the GFC. Now it's back to $30.
Yeah.
If you bought at 17, you sold at $4, you lost 5/6 of your money.
Yeah.
And then if you bought, then you made some money. But if you did nothing but hold on, you've still doubled your money in 10 years. Now, that's not the world's best return, but it gives you a sense of...
It's about 11% per annum over that 10-year period.
It gives you a sense of where to buy and sell, what to do with the money. That's the key one. So frankly, the ones I want to have are all the companies I love already. But I don't care if there's a crash. I don't care if there's a downturn, because in 2026, I want to have those companies in my portfolio because I think they're going to earn more money. Their earnings power is better. Warren Buffett says, concentrate on building the moat, build your competitive advantage. If those businesses are bigger, better, more successful in 5, 10, 15 years, that's all I want. There will be a recession during that period at some point. Mm. I actually genuinely don't care. Share prices falling aren't much fun. I got to tell you, they're kind of a bit depressing when you look at the portfolio
day after day
and look at all the red ink on the screen. But that's the story, right? So which companies do I want? The same companies I always want. You mentioned Soul Patch, I think it's one of the best businesses in the country.
Yep.
Telstra for dividend seekers, a great business. Mm. Trading it, frankly, at a pretty good price now, I think. Plenty of great quality businesses. Little mid-caps, Corporate Travel Management, another company that we would like at the Fool.
Yep.
Great business doing really good things. Will those earnings be hit during a recession? Probably.
Yep.
Do I care? No. And frankly,
are they going to be around in 10 years' time?
You got it.
I think that's the calculus for me. You know, it's a very, very simple starting point. You say, is this business going to be around in 10 years' time? And is it going to be materially more profitable at that point in time? Now, that doesn't mean it's going to grow at a steady rate. It'll be up, it'll be down. But if those two things are true, and I'm not paying a ridiculous price, you know, 100 times earnings or something insane, I'm actually almost guaranteed to do well, right?
Here's one way I try and look at it, one lens, is... try to find companies that are going to be more relevant to their markets in 10 years than they are today.
Yeah.
Now, that relevance is kind of a bit of an area, but I mean, it's a really important word, because that's what tells you how many customers are going to be there, how much they're going to spend there. Think about Apple, right? Apple is incredibly relevant to all of its consumers. We can have the Android-Apple debate, but Apple is just immensely relevant to its consumers. Mm. iTunes, the app, the iPhones, the MacBooks, the App Store, you know, Apple TV, all that, you know, it's immensely relevant to a whole lot of people and will be more and more relevant as the years go past. If you're more relevant, that means more people want to spend more money with you. And that's always going to help grow your bottom line, to your point. And you're right, you can't pay too much for those businesses, any business, but look for increasing relevance. I think that's, for me, that's the light on the hill. That's the thing I'm genuinely looking for when it comes to finding businesses. It's going to be more relevant to more people in 10 years' time than it is today. That's a very, very good start, to use your point.
The way I skin this particular, Cal, I love the saying that, you know, you want to plan for the worst, but hope for the best.
Yeah, nice.
And that is that, you know, again, I'm not going to try and be silly enough to try and call when the next crash is going to come, what's going to cause it, and how far it's going to fall. But I am going to never invest in a company that's never, that has a very poor chance of surviving such an outcome. Now, if it comes and I've got a sensible company, I'm going to be more protected than I otherwise would have. If it doesn't come, well, the business is still a great business and I'm still going to do well as a result of it. So it's that combination of not trying to be too clever. Charlie Munger, who's Warren Buffett's partner and an incredibly intelligent man with a lot of wisdom and experience, has this wonderful saying, which is, tell me where I'm going to die so I don't go there. and where you're going to die in investing is in highly leveraged, super cyclical companies that are overvalued, that, as to your point, third or fourth players in an industry, that is where capital goes to die. So whether there's a crash coming or not, just stay the hell away from those companies, you know, and you will have a fairly robust portfolio of stocks. And I think when the next crash comes, it's not going to be pleasant. It's not going to be easy. But you know what? You'll come out the other side of it. And I would wager you'll come out the other side of it far better than when you went in.
To quote Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.
Okay, perfect. That wraps it up. Look, before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to Triple M's Motley Fool Money through the iTunes store, speaking of iTunes, or your favorite Android podcast app. And of course, you can go to the Triple M website too, triplem.com.au/podcast. And please, if you like what we're doing, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and tell your mates. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening in. We'll be back next time with another dose of foolishness. But until then, fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.